Hello, this is the Winchester Talking Newspaper for the week ending the 9th of February 2018. The extracts from the Hampshire Chronicle this week have been edited by Angela Ling, Carol Fraser and Jane Thomas. And your readers today are John Regan.
Hello there.
And Daphne Popart.
Hello.
And unfortunately, Maria's been held up by traffic, but we hope that she'll be joining us soon. And I'm your presenter, Vara Williams. So, the main headlines this week are Bungling Ram Raiders Target Town Bank, Creative Hub Shelved, and First Clean in 120 Years. So, can we please have the story behind the first headline, John?
Yes. Bungling Ram Raiders Target Town Bank. Ram Raiders destroyed part of a bank in an attempt to steal thousands of pounds in cash. Using a forklift truck, three men smashed their way into Lloyds Bank in Bishop's Waltham around 3 a.m. on Sunday. The cash machine was removed, but abandoned on the pavement, surrounded by rubble and smashed glass. It appears that the ATM toppled off the forklift before it could be removed. The truck was also dumped as the men ran from the scene into nearby Houchin Street. Community leaders have said that the falling number of police officers played a part in the attempted robbery after the town station closed to the public more than 5 years ago. Terry Wilson, Vice Chairman of the Finance, Policy and Resources Committee at Bishop's Waltham Parish Council, said he believed the reduction in the number of officers in the town had played a part in the incident, with the bank placed in the centre of the town. The police station at Bishop's Waltham closed to the public in 2012, with police community support officers placed in the town instead. Councillor Wilson said, "Yes, the reduction in police officers in the town did play a part in this, I would have thought. In terms of the future, whether support officers in the town need more help isn't a question for me to answer." Community members had voiced concerns that Lloyds would close, but Councillor Wilson said he wasn't concerned over that due to the amount of existing customers in the town and the homes still to be built. Councillor Wilson added, "We have 3,000 homes in Bishop's Waltham, and with the current local plan, still could build another 500. I wouldn't worry about that. We're very fortunate to have two thriving banks in the town. This was clearly planned, and I've never seen anything like it in my 30 years within the town." Chairman of Bishop's Waltham Society, Tony Kippenberger, said, "It seems like a freak incident, and highly unusual for the town, as we're normally very peaceful." And that story is accompanied by two photographs, the first showing a lot of police vehicles on the pavement outside the bank, and the second showing the mess created by the robbers before they dashed off.
Creative Hub Shelved. Plans to build a new enterprise hub have been quietly scrapped after Winchester University pulled out of the scheme. Proposals had been put forward to build a Creative Enterprise Centre that would help graduates and business startups in Winchester get off the ground. The project looked set to form a partnership between Winchester City Council and the university, but in October 2016, the university withdrew from discussions, citing the need to prioritise another scheme, which threw the project into doubt. It would have been built on the former railway goods shed, which was previously used by TJ Waste. Speaking at the time, a university spokeswoman said, "After careful consideration, the university has decided to withdraw from discussions with Winchester City Council about the development of a creative enterprise centre. The university is currently working with the council and other partners to deliver a new leisure centre for the city at Bar End, and our focus is on ensuring the success of this project." Despite the setback, there were hopes that the project would continue after leader councillor Caroline Horrell revealed talks had begun with other possible partners last summer. Now, following a request for an update on the scheme, the Chronicle has learnt the project has been quietly scrapped. A spokesman said, "We reviewed the options to establish a creative enterprise centre at Bar End following the University of Winchester's decision not to pursue its interest in the development. Although this particular scheme will not be progressed, the council remains keen to see the site brought back into use and is therefore considering other options for the premises." Responding to the news, Councillor Lucille Thompson, leader of the Liberal Democrat group, and who pressed the council over the project in 2016, said, "That's really disappointing because we have lots of students from the School of Arts, for instance. The idea was that we would provide a small studio to move into. We're really lacking these opportunities, and it did seem like a fantastic idea." She added, "I think one of the other problems was that the council officer had left the council. It is understood that the officer involved in the project was former Assistant Director for Economy and Communities, Eloise Appleby, who left the City Council in October. Ms. Appleby is now working as a freelance consultant for the County Council on its long-term strategy for libraries."
First clean in 120 years. Winchester Cathedral is set to carry out the first clean of the landmark's great screen for around 120 years. Thanks to funding from the Friends of Winchester Cathedral, the project will see conservationists carefully spruce up the stonework, which is more than 540 years old. It follows a programme of urgent repairs to the cathedral's presbytery, which has been carried out over the last 3 years, including re-leading the roof, restoring the windows, and conserving the vault. Already underway, the operation will see McNeilage Conservation clean the great screen with soft brushes and a vacuum cleaner. During the cleaning process, loose dirt and dust will be removed from the stonework, which currently gives a negative appearance, with dark areas lighter than those that should be pale. According to cathedral records, this will be the first time that the great screen has been cleaned since the 1890s. Built between 1450 and 1476, the Great Screen is one of the most iconic features of the Great Church. Ah, and here we have Maria. Sorry, we are recording actually at the moment, so do come and sit down and I will go on with the thing.
We've already heard this twice.
So, sorry readers, listeners I mean, I shall go on. Built between 1450 and 1476, the Great Screen is one of the most iconic features of the Great Church. The original stone statues on the screen were destroyed in 1550 following Edward VI's decree that all religious statuary should be destroyed. However, the bodies of the statues were used to provide stone for new walls in the cathedral close, while the heads were buried in infill behind the screen and were only rediscovered in 1820. The Great Screen's current appearance dates from the late 19th century, when the screen was restored in 1891, with the exception of the central figure of Christ crucified, which was added in 1897. The newly restored presbytery vault and windows will be revealed in April or May, and there's a picture of part of the great screen, two figures from it, with a little bit at the top that I think has already been cleaned and looks really white, and the rest is, yes, a rather dusty colour. Here are the death notices. Cousins, Joan Cousins, aged 86. And another Cousins, Nee Chessel Cousins, peacefully, after much suffering, aged 97. Hutchings, Edwina Dorothy Hutchings, aged 92. McKinley, Crawford McKinley, aged 76. Pierce, Doreen Pierce, in Winchester Hospital, aged 88. Lucia Pratt, Suddenly. Sylvester, Godfrey Mark Sylvester, at home, aged 87. Umland, Sheila Umland. Williams, Patricia Yvonne Williams, unexpectedly, aged 85. And finally, Woolsey, Patricia Woolsey, aged 82. And now we will go over to Maria, please, for the Christian comment.
And Christian comment is titled Carillion and Cathedrals. Today, the seven members of the cathedral chapter are meeting again in time-honoured fashion. One of the issues cathedrals across the country are rather vexed about sounds a bit boring, but it's really important. Governance. There have been a couple of rather embarrassing failures of cathedrals recently in Peterborough and Exeter, which led them to being bailed out. This prompted a report to be commissioned, which was published last month by the Cathedrals Working Group. There is a period of consultation before the church works out what to do next. The report makes various recommendations about who is responsible for what and who is accountable to whom. There have been various meetings and lots of emails flying about between canons, questioning whether the unique laws that govern cathedral structures really need changing. We're not the people responsible in the cathedrals that failed the real problem. Was it about individuals or structures? Should cathedrals embrace more charity law and corporate structures to inspire their own changes? Does the corporate world have the answers? The recent failure of Carillion has rocked the construction industry and raises questions about who was sitting on their board and whether the executives did their jobs properly. When such a big company fails, it's not just the employees and pensioners who suffer, but the suppliers and customers and all the people they serve too. We are still recovering from the banking crisis that erupted in 2009. Corporate structures are not immune from bad practice. So if various structures of governance are fallible, maybe we do need to focus more on the people that inhabit them. The Church of England vision for education demonstrates a Christian commitment serve the good of the whole of society in the way we educate our children. 1/5 of state-funded schools in this country are Church of England schools. That means a lot of adults have been influenced by a Christian school. The Anglican commitment to education seeks to equip school children not just with knowledge, but with wisdom. We seek not just to inspire children, but to fill their lives with hope. Education isn't about being the best in the class, trampling on others to get there. It's about being in a community of learners, growing together. Education isn't just about respecting others. It's about dignity and self-worth that brings creativity, joy, blessing and reconciliation. These influences may possibly help young people develop a moral compass. A few of them grow up to be members of boardrooms, executive directors and auditors. Being Christian sometimes means asking the difficult questions when everyone else wishes you would shut up. But it's those questions that sometimes make people feel uncomfortable that might save the next Carillion or Cathedral.
Letters?
Yes, we will go on to letters. I'm sorry, I've forgotten to announce it.
No problem.
Yes.
Well, the first letter I have is headed Lateral Thinking Needed at HCC. Sir, with reference to the felling of the trees that provided a much-admired starling roost, I would like to say how different things could have been. Suppose the County Council had employed one job seeker, just one would have been sufficient, to wash the cars in the car park and generally tidy up the mess that the starlings have made, and everyone would have been happy. One job seeker doing something really useful and appreciated, thousands of starlings able to live their lives, a line of trees still standing to filter the air, and grateful townsfolk applauding the council's demonstration of caring for the environment. Instead, enraged townsfolk, no trees, troubled starlings, a large bill for the army of saw-wielding tree fellers, a waste of timber, and more polluted air. Come on, HCC, try a little lateral thinking just occasionally. Very disappointed. And that comes from Sarah Shawcross of Sarum Road in Winchester.
And now, on the same theme, we have a letter from Councillor Roy Perry, who is, of course, the leader of Hampshire County Council. Sir, following the Chronicle's recent article, Fury as Winchester Fire Station Trees, used by city's much-loved starlings, cut down, of January the 25th, I would like to clarify Hampshire County Council's role following the decision by Hampshire Fire and Rescue Service to remove a small number of Leylandii trees at Winchester Fire Station. Your readers will wish to be aware that the County Council had in fact been contacted by the Fire Service following their concerns about roosting starlings and their impact on operational vehicles responding to incidents, as well as the health and safety of staff. A range of options were presented to the Fire Service, who decided that the removal of the trees was the most effective solution to meet their requirements. Therefore, the work was carried out and far ahead of the nesting season. The trees were also scheduled to be removed at the request of the Fire Service as the roots were threatening structural damage to a retaining wall and adjacent building at the site. The trees were not in a conservation area and were not subject to tree protection orders, so no formal permission was needed to carry out the work. We understand the starlings remain in the area and continue to roost in nearby trees. And as I said, that's from Councillor Roy Perry, leader of Hampshire County Council, The Castle, Winchester.
And now, changing the subject, the next letter comes from Keith Hatter. Sir, may I echo and add to the arguments presented by Mr. Duxbury in the article Campaign for Crossing, Chronicle February the 1st, there is no safe crossing point of Worthy Lane and Worthy Road north of the junction of Worthy Lane with Andover Road. The east side of Worthy Road, and hence Riverside Park and the city centre, are therefore not safely accessible to many pedestrians travelling from the substantial residential area between Andover Road and Worthy Road. Not only are children and their parents subject to the dangers caused by the inadequacies of the traffic islands pointed out in the above article, but all users of wheelchairs and mobility scooters are also presented with the same hazards. As a blind person, I always avoid traffic islands because I cannot be sure that there is no traffic approaching from one direction if the noise of traffic approaching from the other direction masks the absence of sound for which I am listening. Islands are not merely of no use to me, but present a potential trip hazard in the middle of the road. The installation of a pedestrian-controlled crossing would provide a safe and convenient walking route from a residential area to both the city centre and other facilities on its north side, thus improving both radial and cross-radial connectivity. Let us hope that it is installed while its cost is only financial and has not been incalculably increased by the inclusion of serious injury or life. Keith Hatter, Chairman, Winchester Area Access for All.
And here's a rather surprising call from Keith Webb to increase council tax. Sir, probably surprisingly to some, I welcome the fact that council tax is set to rise in 2018-19. On checking through my records, I find that tax on my house has only risen by about 14% in the last 10 years, whilst RPI has risen nearly 32% over the same period, and house values have risen even more. What I feel needs to change is an increase in the number of bands, so that those living in the very biggest houses are seen by everyone to be making a proportionate contribution to city and council finances. There are so many things that require more money spent on them, other than the purely social issues which have led to closure of much-needed facilities required by the less fortunate amongst us. Care for those with special needs, respite centres to give carers a break, and the provision of better facilities for the homeless, to name just a few. Here's another example. The roads in the area are an absolute disgrace. Every time we have heavy rainfall, badly repaired potholes show up again, and I feel sure that all will agree that our roads now are far worse than they used to be. Going for the cheapest short-term repairs is not a good investment. This comes down to very poor overseeing of the work being done by the contractors hired to work on the roads. Additional money raised from the increased tax must be better spent than hitherto. And that comes from Keith Webb, Quarry Road in Winchester.
And now a letter from Andrew Rutter. Sir, the much-loved water garden off Colebrook Street may be more interesting than people suspect. In 1975, landscape students from Merestwood College visited Winchester to study landscape problems and opportunities. I was asked to talk to them in the morning, and after lunch they had a fascinating guided talk from Graham Drew, art master at Winchester College. He told them that in the 1930s, when the Winchester MP Sir Peter Smithers had acquired his fine house in a rundown part of Colebrook Street, they got together to discuss their vision for a walk starting in Water Close, passing through the Cathedral Close and Winchester College, ending in the water meadows near Garnier Road, St Cross. Sir Peter decided to buy the land and demolished several cottages and constructed the water gardens to open up a special eastern view of the cathedral and introduce a classical sculpture in a medieval setting. This would be the start of a justed changing series of visual experiences through the close, creating gardens backing onto College Street, through the main college entrance, and out onto Meads and the southern Saxon Gate to the playing fields, where a great circle of horse chestnut trees would be planted across the Itchen to give a formal setting to St Catherine's Hill. This would involve adjustment to paving, planting, perhaps gates to enhance the townscape when opportunities arose. As a relative newcomer, it made a deep impression on me, and I have often wondered if Graham Drew left their vision and any records of changes that he had made to the college archives. Clearly at the time, this would have been of most interest to Wykhamists and their guests, but now would make a wonderful City College guided walk, developing visitors' understanding of Winchester's evolution. Sadly, over time, the beautiful magnolia tree has grown so big that it puts the classical sculpture into shade, and it has become dirty, devaluing its original function as an eye-catcher. I hope that the idea of a magnificent walk can be rediscovered and a solution can be found to the garden's upkeep so that it can be reinvigorated. That comes from Andrew Rutter, retired City Council Conservation Architect, St John's Road, Winchester.
And the next letter comes from Paul Hay and concerns the subject of loneliness. Sir, In this, our 50th year, Anchor Housing Association recognises that loneliness is nearing epidemic proportions and is something which concerns the older people living with us. According to the campaign to end loneliness, more than half the country's 75-year-olds currently live alone, which increases the likelihood of mortality by 26%. As we deliver housing, care and support to 40,000 older people from our 1,000 locations across England, Anchor does its utmost to prevent this. The older people living in retirement housing properties like mine benefit from living in a thriving community. I'm also around if they need any support. That is why I welcome the government's decision to appoint Tracy Crouch as its Minister for Loneliness. We wish her every success. And local retailers can also help older people, particularly those living alone, to reduce their sense of loneliness. Anchor's Standing Up for Sitting Down campaign is asking retailers to provide seating so that older shoppers, as well as disabled people and pregnant women, can rest mid-shop. A shopping trip may be a weekly chore for many, but for some older people living alone, it's a chance for social interaction and could be a lifesaver. Paul Hay, manager, Watersmeet, Chesil Street, Winchester.
Yes, and this next one's a brief and punchy letter headed Ditch the Post. Sir, the council says it needs to save more money, so get rid of the police commissioner. When he was installed, council tax went up, obviously, to pay his salary, and now he demands another increase to staff an office for himself. It appears he wants to pass on the work to other people and not do anything himself, so get rid of him. The old way was better. A police officer doing the routine, so train him or her to carry out the finances and save money. And that comes from G.N. Barrett, who lives in Nicholson Place in Alresford.
Now, Jill Collymore writes, Sir, I support Michael Carden's views about the proposed new hotel in Market Street in the Chronicle of February the 1st. In its unique position in the centre of the city, and so very close to the cathedral, the east end of Market Street, together with the back of the Mercure Hotel, is at present a disgrace to Winchester, with its nondescript facades, dustbins and lack of charm. So let's hope that a well-designed new hotel will change this. It is an opportunity to improve the townscape of this part of the city centre, which should not be missed. Comes from Jill Collymore, Cannon Street, Winchester.
And the next letter from David Selby describes my trip to Winchester this morning. Sir, having seen the proposals for the M3A34 alterations, it seems to be a very expensive way of not quite solving the problems associated with this troublesome junction. Twice in the last month, I have witnessed the chaos caused by an accident on the A34 southbound carriageway. On the last occasion, the tailback from Winchester passed South Wanston and was less than a mile from Sutton Scotney. These accidents will not stop as a result of these proposals. And in addition, the engineers agreed that the crossover from the slip road onto the A34 going north, and then in a relatively few yards onto the A33 for Kingsworthy, looks like an accident waiting to happen. Surely a simpler and possibly a cheaper alternative would be for northbound traffic to come off the M3 at Junction 11 and travel on a newly built northern ring road round Winchester to Three Maids Island and onto the A34 from there. This would have the advantage of an excellent alternative route around Winchester should similar accidents occur to that reported above. And it would stop the procession of 40-ton trucks weaving their way through the city. Come on, Highways England, look at the bigger picture. If the overall purpose of the plan is to keep traffic moving and save hauliers and their customers a lot of money. David Selby, West Hill Road North, South Wanston.
This next letter asks the question, a city of snobs? Sir, I have followed with interest the comments made on the proposal for a travel lodge in Winchester. Most of the correspondence has been against the proposal. I'd like to make two comments. Firstly, not everyone visiting Winchester is in a position to pay the rates charged by the Royal Hotel or the Wessex Hotel, and a budget hotel would open up to Winchester to less affluent visitors. Secondly, the websites of both the Royal Hotel and the Wessex Hotel point to pay and display parking for their clients. This is also the case in the Travelodge website, so anyone making a reservation with them will be well aware of the parking limitations. I think back to the planning applications for Waitrose and Aldi. One was welcomed, while efforts were made to reject the other. Could it be that Winchester is becoming a city of snobs? And that question is asked by Norman Pynchon, who lives in Keats Close in South Wanston, near Winchester.
Now, a letter from Ben Isaac. Sir, there has been a lot of discussion about the number of squash courts at the proposed new leisure centre at Bar End. However, seemingly no talk of replacement tennis courts. There is already a shortage of public tennis courts in the area, particularly indoors or with floodlights, and the four at River Park are always busy. Has this not been taken into consideration? No wonder the future for British tennis looks so bleak post-Murray. And that comes from Ben Isaac, Queen Street, Twyford.
And the final letter comes from Diana Kirkby. Sir, I would be fascinated to hear how permission was granted to fell several trees where starlings were roosting, Chronicle, February the 1st. I have a beech tree on my property, which over the years has encroached on the drive, causing damage, and has rendered one side of the garage unusable. The most that the City Council will allow me to do is trim the odd twig. Diana Kirkby, Nations Hill, Kingsworthy.
And that's the end of the letters. Excuse me. If you wish to contact the Hampshire Chronicle, you can do so by telephoning 01962 860 836, emailing news@hampshirechronicle, or one word, .co.uk, or writing to the editor at 5 Upper Brook Street, Winchester, SO23 8AL. And now, from the files brings us the historical news, starting with 200 years ago, please, John.
Yes, 200 years ago, two rather gloomy pieces, I'm afraid, but might give us a bit of a snapshot of the times. 200 years ago, Monday, February the 9th, 1818. On Thursday last, an inquest was taken by Mr. Todd at Woodcote of Charlotte Cooper, aged 10 years, who came by her death in the following extraordinary manner. The deceased, in company with other girls of her age, was playing blind man's buff near a pond at the end of her father's house, when in running with her playmates, she unfortunately descended the bank into the pond, and though immediate assistance was procured, and she was taken out within a very few minutes, every effort to restore animation proved ineffectual. Verdict, accidental death. And the second piece. On Thursday, an inquest was held on the body of Miss Mary Simmons, a young lady of 21 years of age, daughter of Mr. Simmons of Rose Street, Christchurch. This young lady, after a courtship of nearly 5 years, was, with her parents' consent, to have been married to the object of her choice, a respectable young man. And 1 o'clock on Monday last was the time for the celebration of the nuptials. The intended bride retired to her apartment, as it was supposed, to dress, but remaining too long, her sister went upstairs to tell her to come down. Receiving no answer, she went in and found her sister lying on the bed in a state of insensibility. On the table were found a cup of coffee and another cup empty, which was proved to have contained some oil of vitriol, which was kept for the purpose of cleaning copper. Medical assistance was instantly sent for, but she died in 24 hours. Verdict, insanity.
And 100 years ago, I'm afraid this is the same theme. So the first item, a boy named Walter Hilliken, 14 years of age, was found dead by a signalman on the London and South Western Railway near Albrook, shortly before 2 o'clock on Thursday afternoon. His parents reside at 4 Archers Road, Eastleigh, and the boy, who had been working in a government factory, was home in the dinner hour. The body was removed to the Victoria Inn to await an inquest. And the second item, on Thursday, the city coroner, Henry White Esquire, opened an inquiry at the Guildhall on the body of Edith Eva Kathleen Mundy, aged 2.5 years, who died at 17 Cannon Street, where she had been in the charge of a foster mother. During the course of the evidence given, Dr. Colclough said the child weighed only 18 pounds, where the normal weight was 28 pounds. He also detailed several ulcers and bruises which he found on the child's head and body, and at the conclusion of the medical evidence, the coroner said he should adjourn the inquiry. In the meanwhile, he advised the foster mother to get legal advice. The inquiry was adjourned to Wednesday at 2 p.m.
Well, the two items from 50 years ago, Saturday, February the 10th, 1968, are not quite so depressing. An 8% increase in the Guildhall charges was approved on Wednesday by Winchester City Council. A report of the Lands Committee stated that the increase was not unreasonable in the view of the additional expenditure incurred in staffing and maintaining the building over the past 8 years. The income for lettings for 1967-68 has been estimated at £5,040, with expenditure applicable to public use of £12,845. Alderman Mrs. Dillis Neat asked the chairman of the Lands Committee if better cloakroom accommodation could be provided at the Guildhall in the near future for women members of the council and women magistrates. The ladies' cloakroom is often let for various functions and it is often used by barristers during court sittings, she said. The provision is quite inadequate. Alderman Eric Neat said this year was the 50th anniversary of women getting the vote, but it had taken Winchester City Council a long time to get their women's lavatories in order. And the second item, Hampshire was finally freed of foot and mouth restrictions after 4 months on Wednesday. Under a new foot and mouth control area order, an area south of the line from the Severn to the Thames has been cleared, but still in the control area are Greater London and Reading, although the rest of Berkshire has been de-restricted. Cattle markets in the south have not been severely hit by the disease, although Hampshire auctioneers have, through choice, decided not to hold breeding stock sales.
And now we move forward to 25 years ago, Friday, February the 5th, 1993. First piece. Winchester College's controversial plans to develop part of a city centre conservation area came before a planning inspector this week. The college wants to build 5 homes with garages and parking and to renovate an existing house at 35 Wharf Hill. The application was turned down by the City Council last year. Joseph Harper QC for the college told Inquiry Inspector Andrew Mead that the college had an outstanding architectural record over the last 600 years and was not about to scar the landscape. But City Council planner David Diamond said the proposal would upset the fragile balance between urban and rural Winchester, ruin the views of the Cathedral Tower and Wolvesey Palace, and spoil the character of the riverbank near the Black Bridge. Second piece. An incident room set up at Alton Police Station to investigate sadistic horse attacks has been inundated with phone calls. The man leading the hunt, Chief Inspector Des Thomas and his team of 10 officers, have been flooded with more than 600 calls from people offering information about the mutilations. People have even phoned from America and Scandinavia. Police have codenamed their investigation Operation Mountbatten after the mare which was killed in Fourmarks just over a week ago. She was the first animal to die at the scene of the attack. Reward for information has now exceeded £17,000.
On to the editorial comment, please, Daphne.
And this is headed, Was Bank Job Thanks to Police Cutbacks? We may never know for sure, but it would be interesting to find out if police cutbacks were a factor in the brazen attempt to steal a cash machine from Lloyds Bank in Bishop's Waltham. Did the gang who stole a forklift tractor to execute their plan reckon on the limited chance of their 3 a.m. activities being spotted by a police patrol? We will only know for sure if the gang is brought to justice and decides to tell us. The police, under severe financial pressure in this age of austerity, have been reducing officer numbers as reported in detail by this newspaper. That means senior officers have been concentrating their manpower in the bigger towns, working on the not unreasonable assumption that that is where they are more likely to be needed. But a spin-off is that places such as Bishop's Waltham, Romsey and Alresford are seeing fewer officers and therefore a greater chance of success for such raids. Having said that, while the first part of the criminal's plan went well, the second left a lot to be desired. The aim was to get the cash machine onto a getaway vehicle. Instead, they abandoned it on the rubble. The bank was lucky this time, but such things will probably happen again if robbers calculate that there won't be any officers nearby the next time.
And on to first person. Who's writing first person this time, John?
Well, it's Khalid Aziz. Khalid's been off on his holidays, and so he heads his piece, Cuba, a lesson for us all? Go before it changes and gets spoilt, I was told. And with that warning ringing in my ears, we made plans for Cuba, a vast Caribbean island off the coast of Venezuela and within easy reach of Miami. We were to be travellers rather than tourists. Not for us the all-inclusive beachfront resort hotels run by the state for much-needed hard currency. We were to drive ourselves around in a hire car, an adventure in itself. After a painfully slow airport luggage delivery, we were greeted by delightful people who ushered us to our waiting taxi, a 1959 American Ford, which, although showing its age, was charming. Windows down, we breathed in the heady atmosphere of mainly thick diesel fumes spewed out from every vehicle, large and small. The climate change accords have clearly passed Cuba by. Until 1959, Cuba, and in particular Havana, was the playground of rich and often dodgy Americans. The people of the island were mainly in abject poverty. So when Fidel Castro and his lieutenants, included Camilo Cienfuegos and the iconic Ernesto Che Guevara, staged their coup to overthrow the US puppet Fulgencio Batista, they were welcomed with flowers and cheering. Today, Fidel's communist vision has delivered education, nourishment, all looked well fed, some too much so, and excellent healthcare. Unfortunately, it hasn't delivered much else. The place is simply falling apart. Until the demise of the Soviet Union, Cuba's main income came from cane sugar sold to Russia at inflated prices in exchange for oil. With perestroika came economic collapse, as Cuba's sugar cane couldn't compete on world markets and was effectively shut out of Europe through directives decreeing that our own sugar should come from homegrown beet. Since then, the island's main export has been doctors, mainly to Venezuela under communist-friendly Chavez, and again, in exchange for oil. Cash remains the big problem. They run two currencies, a local peso and a tourist peso, roughly equaling one US dollar and worth 25 local pesos. Tourists are charged through the nose. In the countryside, you can get a coffee for just one peso. In towns, you can be charged 40 times that. There appears to have been little money for infrastructure too. Maintenance is an alien concept. Granted, there are large motorway-like autopistas, but they're riddled with potholes, some so large you could lose an entire wheel. Internet is painfully slow and accessible only by purchasing a card at the state internet office, where you can expect to queue for at least half an hour, and then making your way to a hotspot in the town square, where along with hundreds of others, you attempt over and over again to log on. After the ailing Fidel handed over to his brother Raul in 2008, there was some liberalisation of the economy. Large enterprises, hotels and utilities are still state-owned, but small businesses, B&Bs known as casas, and restaurants were permitted. And very good we found them too. Basic, but clean, and with their owners flexing their newly found entrepreneurial muscles, keen to offer good service and good food. There are some new cars too. Fidel had banned the purchase of cars, so we have all of these 50s classics in Aspic, kept going by Cuban ingenuity. The trouble is, with market liberalisation, there has been a flight of intellect from the state system. Over 40% now work in the private sector. One of our guides was an English teacher, who told us that he earned three times as much from working in tourism as he did in his day job. Obama had lifted the ban on US travel to the island only for the policy to be thrown crunchingly into reverse by Trump. So there are very few Americans here, and so very few dollars. Rapid change won't be happening soon. Cubans are friendly and welcoming. The nightlife in cities like Havana and Trinidad buzzes, and you feel safe. It's worth a look, if only to see what 60 years of totalitarianism can bring, and to remind us of how lucky we are to live where we do. I can think of one or two politicians who might well benefit from an educational tour.
Now we go over to the alternative news with Belle Garum.
And there are three items today, with the first one titled NHS Panto Raises Funds. Staff from Hampshire Hospitals NHS Foundation Trust raised thousands for charity at their annual hospital pantomime. Tickets sold out for the performances, which saw staff from Winchester, Andover and Basingstoke hospitals perform a special retelling of Jack and the Beanstalk entitled Jack and the Basingstalk. Roles in the performance at the Haymarket Theatre in Basingstoke were open to everyone working at Hampshire Hospitals, with casual auditions held last September and weekly rehearsals held to ensure everything was all right on the night. The event raised £4,574.32 through ticket sales and collection buckets. The money will be split and donated to the North Hampshire Medical Fund, the Pink Place and the Arc Cancer Centre charity. Sharon Watson, who helped organise the pantomime and played Daisy the Cow, said, "I want to say a massive thank you to all the cast who gave up their time over the weekends to make sure we put on the best show we could." She added, "Everything went really well on the day, and we put on such a great show. Everyone had such a good time performing, and the crowd were amazing. I would like to say thank you to everyone who bought tickets and came to see us." And there is a photo with this, with a scene from Jack and the Basingstalk. It's not ever so clear. There are four members of the cast kneeling down on the stage.
Now, don't be startled, but the Belle Garum has chosen to head his next item, Flying Rats Plague. Let's find out what he means. Ah, here we are, pigeons. For some, they are merely a part of living in a city. For others, they're flying rats. However, for one city councillor, Winchester's pigeons are public enemy number one. At a recent town forum, Councillor Ian Tate said that pigeons were ruining Winchester and that this, quote, blight needed to be dealt with, taken care of, you know, whacked. Okay, he didn't turn into a mob enforcer, but the message was clear. The pigeons have to go, by force, if necessary. Councillor Tate said, they are ruining the Buttercross, the city centre, and there's pigeon excrement all over the Guildhall. But when was the last time you saw a pigeon in Winchester city centre? Asks Belgarum. Let alone this biblical plague of winged monstrosities that are dissolving ancient monuments and the literal foundations of our local democracy with streams of acrid effluence. Belgarum can count on one hand the amount of pigeons seen in the city in the last month. With this in mind, perhaps it's the first council scheme that is achievable in a single afternoon with a large net. And there's a picture of three pigeons looking rather sweet, actually, accompanying that rather frightening article.
And the last item is headed Hedgehogs in Sharp Decline. At least half the population of native hedgehogs has been lost from the British countryside over the last two decades, warned two wildlife charities in a report out yesterday. The State of Britain's Hedgehogs 2018, published by the British Hedgehog Preservation Society, BHPS, and People's Trust for Endangered Species, PTES, is the only comprehensive review of the status of Britain's hedgehogs. The report shows that hedgehogs in rural areas are in severe decline, with their numbers plummeting by half since the millennium. There are many reasons hedgehogs are in trouble, said Emily Wilson from Hedgehog Street, a public action campaign run by PTES and BHPS. The intensification of agriculture through the loss of hedgerows and permanent grasslands, increased field sizes and the use of pesticides, which reduce the amount of prey available, are all associated with the plunge in numbers of hedgehogs in rural areas.
And now here are some events that are happening in the next few weeks. In fact, the first one that I've been asked to tell you about is that Winchester Chamber Music Festival, which runs from the 4th to the 7th of May, has its general booking opening. In fact, it opened on the 5th of February. So you can find full details about the Chamber Music Festival at www.winchesterchambermusic.com. And tickets are available from the Winchester Theatre Royal box office. And the telephone number for that is 01962 840 440. Then on Saturday the 24th of February at 7:30 p.m. there's a concert by the Hampshire Youth Orchestra at Winchester Cathedral with over 300 young players. Tickets cost £8 and £6, or for concessions £5 and £3. To book, ring the Cathedral box office on 01962 857 275. The week beginning the 19th of February has three shows at the Theatre Royal Winchester. On Tuesday the 20th, there's a dance interpretation of A Midsummer Night's Dream. On Thursday the 22nd, the opera The Magic Flute will be staged. And on the Friday and Saturday, there's a comedy written and directed by John Godber called The Scary Bikers, about life, love and staying on your bike. For more details of all of these and to buy tickets, ring the box office on 01962 840 440. And it sounds a bit odd, but an opera is coming to the Science Centre and Planetarium on Thursday, March the 1st. Pop-up opera is a company that aims to broaden the appeal of opera by taking it into unusual spaces and making it intimate and engaging. The opera is Hansel and Gretel, and tickets are now available online, though it doesn't give a website address, but I suppose you just put in Winchester Science Centre. And that's the end of what's on. And now lighting up time ends today, Friday the 9th of February, at 7:29 a.m. and begins again at 5:08 p.m. On Wednesday the 14th of February, it ends at 7:20 a.m. and begins again at 5:19 p.m. If you know someone who's sight impaired and would like to receive our recordings, or if you have a problem with the recording you've received from us, please telephone Irene Dowding on 01962 870 370. That's 01962 870 370. Now we continue with further items of general news. So over to Maria.
Biker killed in high-speed crash on the A272. A biker was speeding moments before he died in a collision, an inquest heard. Mark Russell, 45, was hit by oncoming traffic after losing control near a notorious accident black spot. Mr. Russell died in the crash involving his Yamaha, a Land Rover Freelander and a Skoda Fabia on the A272 at Cheesfoot Head near Winchester. He was thrown into the path of the Land Rover after losing control of his Yamaha YZ-FR1 just after 12:40 on October the 15th. Claire Belcher, the driver of the Skoda, said, "I saw him in my rearview mirror. He was fishtailing and fighting to keep control of the bike. The bike collided with the back of the car, forcing it onto the verge." John Batchelor, driver of the Land Rover, said, "It all happened so fast. Suddenly the rider was on our side of the road, skidding towards us. There was no time to brake or avoid him." An off-duty nurse, an army medic, went to Mr. Russell's aid, but the father of four died at the scene. Witness Trevor DeFoyt said Mr. Russell, a vehicle painter of Devonshire Road Week, appeared to be travelling at 80 to 90 miles per hour in excess of the speed limit moments before the crash. He told his wife, "That guy's going quite quick." Crash investigator Anthony Clifford said that he found Mr. Russell had been driving in an aggressive manner before the crash. He said, "I estimate that the Yamaha was in excess of the speed limit while negotiating the bend. The crash was a result of the action or inaction of Mr. Russell." Pathologist Dr. Adnan Al-Badri concluded that he died instantly. A report by toxicologist Peter Street revealed that Mr. Russell was sober at the time of his death. Senior coroner Graham Short concluded that the death was the result of a road traffic accident. His family did not wish to comment at the inquest on Monday, but they previously paid tribute. "Mark will be deeply missed. He was a wonderful husband, loving father to four boys, and proud granddad to a beautiful little boy who adored him so much. We will miss him every day. He was a wonderful man who would do anything for anyone." And there is a photo of Mark Russell in happier times with this article.
And here's this week's letter from Westminster, which this week comes from George Hollingbury MP. "Politicians can sometimes be viewed as a grey bunch without much of a sense of humour. So I hope that this story might show you another side of life inside the Westminster bubble. The tale starts with a man from Newcastle-upon-Tyne writing to the Prime Minister to complain about something that was irritating him about Prime Minister's question time. This wonderful gentleman said in his letter how much he loved watching PMQs every week, but wrote, "The only fault for me is that fairly recently, one of your blue-suited MPs has decided to sit behind you and do all his office work from a huge lever arch file with bright yellow index stickers, which he annoyingly flicks through, opens and closes, makes notes, etc., whenever you, as the PM, is making any urgent or important response to the likes of Citizen Corbyn. I find it almost impossible to concentrate on what you are saying because of the scribe carrying on his office work immediately behind your head. Would you kindly tell him to lay off with the paperwork while you are busy with the vital exchanges?" He then went on to ask the PM to get the person to sit on the end of the back row of benches to avoid this horrible distraction. Well, a few days after it was delivered to Downing Street, a copy of the letter landed on my desk with a note from Number 10 which said, "We thought you might enjoy the attached letter, which seems to be about you." Well, it couldn't really have been about anybody else, because I do sit behind the Prime Minister every week. So I phoned the gentleman up. "Hello," I said. "I am George Hollingbury, and I am the Parliamentary Private Secretary to the Prime Minister. Thank you for your letter about the MP sitting behind the Prime Minister." And quick as a flash, this man replied, "It's you! You're the bloke behind the Prime Minister." In the lovely conversation that followed, I explained that it was actually my job to help the Prime Minister during PMQs, as she doesn't know every detail of every question, and that's what I'm doing, and it's certainly not my office work. Now, this was a man who really does watch PMQs very carefully, because he had also noticed that the PM's other and relatively new Parliamentary Private Secretary, Seema Kennedy, had been sitting next to me for a few months. So I made him a promise. I told him, "The next time I know the camera's on the PM and our hands are in shot, Seema and I will give you a thumbs up." And we did. I never found out if he was tuning in that day, but I hope he was. I know it would have given him a smile as he watched.
The most famous bald penguin in the world dies. Tributes have been paid to international superstar Ralph at Marwell Zoo after the 19-year-old penguin passed away. Humboldt Ralph, who had been at the zoo since 2006, was the oldest of the zoo's penguins. After battling arthritis for 8 months, medical staff decided it was best to prevent any unnecessary distress and euthanise Ralph. Born on New Year's Day in 1999, he spent most of his life at Marwell after arriving from Germany's Nuremberg Zoo. He became a superstar when he began wearing a wetsuit for protection due to molting much quicker than other penguins, leaving him with sensitive bald patches. Initially, the keepers at the zoo fashioned a wetsuit from the leg of an adult one, but in 2013, Californian surf brand O'Neill stepped in. They signed Ralph up to a custom wetsuit sponsorship deal, usually reserved for surf and snowboarding stars. James Ellis, Bird's team leader, said, "It is very sad that we have had to say goodbye to Ralph, the oldest penguin in our colony. Ralph was simply unique and never far from the spotlight with his mischievous antics, which will be sorely missed by everyone who knew and looked after him. Ralph had a long and happy life, and everyone has wonderful memories of him." Ralph and his partner Coral raised several chicks at the zoo, including current colony member Calippo. Jan Michaelis, European Marketing Manager of O'Neill, said, "All of the team at O'Neill Wetsuits are saddened to hear of Ralph's passing. We first helped Ralph with a custom-made wetsuit in 2013. He has been considered a much-loved and unique member of our team ever since. And there's a lovely picture, quite touching, of Ralph standing like penguins do with his flippers out, wearing this sweet little wetsuit."
Rosemary and Cecil celebrate 60 years of marriage despite forbidden love. Give and take, That is the secret of the Hampshire couple, who will today celebrate their 60th wedding anniversary. Rosemary and Cecil White from Chandler's Ford met in Winchester back in 1950, when Cecil moved from Portsmouth following the Second World War. The pair had ended up living only a few doors away from each other and started dating in 1953. Rosemary, 79, who used to work as a nurse, said, "Our first date was at my mother's garden gate. I wasn't allowed to go out. She was very protective and she didn't want me to go out with Cecil. It was in Rosemary's garden that Cecil, 80, a former plumber, proposed. The couple got engaged in 1955 and married in Christchurch in Winchester in 1958 before making the short trip along the south coast to Weymouth for their honeymoon. They now have two sons, two grandsons and two great-granddaughters. When I woke up that day, the snow was lying on the ground," Rosemary said. "We went to the church and then we had a party with 105 guests. Whatever we do it together. He is my best friend, my companion, and he'll always be. I love him and I wouldn't change him for the world." Rosemary said that they love going out for lunch when they can, and added that the secret of staying together for so long and love each other is to give and take. You have to give and take, and if you have an argument, you just have to say sorry and make up. We argue, every couple does, but it's making up afterwards that is important. The couple say they will be spending the day with their family to celebrate their anniversary. And there's a lovely photo of the couple together looking very, very happy and very, very well.
Metal detectorist coining it in after finding rare coin near Winchester. A metal detectorist is celebrating a rare find at a secret location near Winchester. Richard Patterson from West End has unearthed only the second coin minted by the first Brexiteer. Emperor Carausius ruled for 7 years when he rejected Roman rule and appointed himself leader of an independent Britain. And now the silver coin is expected to fetch thousands at an auction. Mr. Patterson was with the Hampshire Detector Club in November when his detector gave off a loud beep. Just inches below the surface, he found the coin with markings that the 62-year-old granddad and landscape gardener didn't recognise. But thinking nothing more of it, he put it in his bag and carried on. It wasn't until he got home and tried to identify his find that he realised how rare it is. He said, "We'd already found a few bits of lead, and that usually means there's been some action there. But the next day, someone saw something like it in a magazine that had sold for £17,000. It took me about 4 hours of searching to work out what it was, because there's hardly any information on Carausius or the coin. I realised that it was a silver coin, but I didn't have a clue about what it was and how much it might be worth. I went into shock when I found out." The coin will go to auction on February the 21st. And is expected to fetch between £7,000 and £9,000. Mr. Patterson will have to split his haul with the landowning farmer. The location remains a tightly guarded secret. He said, "We have a few problems with what we call night hawks, people who go detecting at night without permission, so the location must be kept under wraps." The coin was minted during Carausius' brief reign of 286 to 293. It shows the emperor's head on one hand and a lion on the other. Experts say it's an exceptionally fine specimen. Mr. Patterson said he'll now use the cash to pay for a new car exhaust. There's a couple of pictures with it. The first shows Richard Patterson proudly displaying all of his metal detecting equipment in his garden in West End. And the second inset is a picture of the coin itself, which I must say doesn't look that impressive, but clearly must be to fetch that kind of money.
Stalled housing scheme to continue within days. Developers have said that a scheme to build more than 200... Excuse me. A scheme to build more than 200 homes in Winchester that has stalled will restart within days. David Gilchrist, Development Director at Barclay Homes, has told the Chronicle that they were on target to start works on the site of the former police headquarters in Romsey Road in the next week. It is envisioned that the scheme will take 3.5 years to build, depending on market conditions, and should be finished in the summer of 2021. Mr. Gilchrist said, construction has been delayed due to Barclay making some amendments to the scheme and the submission of information to discharge planning conditions. Despite the six-month delay, Winchester City Council has said that it will not impact the council's aim to build 600 new council homes by 2020, despite the Romsey Road development including a large amount of social and affordable housing. Winchester City Council leader and portfolio holder for housing, Councillor Caroline Horrell, said, "Progression upon the Barclay Homes site in Romsey Road will not impact the council's ambition to build 600 homes by 2020, as the Section 106 housing agreement is being developed by a registered provider. There was an agreed planning permission, but the developer asked for a variation, which has incurred a slight delay to the project. However, we can confirm that this still includes the provision of the previously agreed 40% of affordable housing." Last summer, a meeting of Winchester City Council heard that the redevelopment of the old police headquarters had stalled. Councillor Lucille Thompson said, "Nothing is happening there in spite of hoardings saying the launch would be in April. Now they have changed the hoardings. There is no work going on. Rumours are circulating locally as to what is happening." As previously reported, the Barclay Homes scheme has seen the force's former West Hill base, which stood for more than 50 years, demolished and replaced with a development of 208 new homes comprising flats and townhouses. The scheme, which also includes an underground car park and path for bikes and pedestrians, was approved by planners in February 2016. Demolition work on the seven-storey building began in December 2016. In February last year, a source told the Hampshire Chronicle that the scheme may have been delayed due to Brexit, which Barclay Homes denied at the time. A saleswoman at Barclay Homes at the time said, "The plans are still being amended. We are not due to launch the site until summer of next year."
Stalker left victim in fear of her life. A respected tutor and author has avoided prison despite a campaign of stalking which saw him commando crawling towards his victim. Graham Steed, 68, admitted stalking the former charity shop worker for nearly 2 years, during which time he hired a private investigator to follow and take photos of her and a partner, and tried to install covert cameras in a neighbour's garden. Steed, who pleaded guilty to stalking with serious harm and distress, also visited her on numerous occasions at the charity shop in Bishop's Waltham where she worked, despite agreeing to stay away, and sent letters of complaint to her employer as well as that of her partner. Before being sentenced at Winchester Crown Court last Friday, Basingstoke Magistrates Court heard how Steed of Hollybourne Road, Romsey, had been a tutor for the woman's daughter. And after his services were no longer needed, he had remained a friend of the family before the relationship broke down. He also sent photos taken by the private investigator of her with her partner to her husband. And on one occasion, she spotted Steed commando crawling towards the car she was in with her partner. In a victim impact statement, she said, "It was extremely distressing. He became obsessed with me. Whenever I'm out and about, I'm always looking over my shoulder. I'm in fear of my life. He strikes me as a Jekyll and Hyde character, projecting the front of an elderly and kind gentleman while actually he is a lonely and controlling man. The victim added that she now regularly has to check the locks on her windows and doors, has her security light turned on constantly, and often goes without eating. Mitigating, Adrian Knight told Winchester Crown Court that Steed was ashamed of himself and had been suffering from depression for more than a decade, which he would be seeking psychiatric support for and was on medication for it. The court also heard there was a number of positive character references submitted for Steed and that his biggest concern was what would happen to his wife, who he cared for, if he was jailed. Sentencing Steed to a 12-month prison sentence suspended for 2 years, as well as a rehabilitation requirement and 150 hours of unpaid work, Judge Jane Miller QC described him as an intimacy-seeking stalker and told him his letters and actions showed obsessive and weird behaviour. She added, "You represent a high risk of stalking to women." He was also ordered to pay a victim surcharge and a restraining order was put in place.
Boomtown growth partly rejected. I warn you in advance, this article is very heavy on numbers, so bear with me. Civic chiefs have approved revised plans for Boomtown. The City Council has announced that its licensing committee backed plans for the festival to maintain its current attendance limit of 59,999, but to allow for 5,000 additional staff, artists and their guests, as well as 1,000 more tickets for local residents. The council also approved plans which will see 16,000 attendees arrive on the Wednesday, in a move which Boomtown say will ease traffic congestion at the event on the Matterley Estate east of Winchester. However, the council has rejected plans which would have seen noise levels rise from 65 decibels to 70 decibels during performances from headline acts, and increased to 68 decibels at all other times. The council has instead imposed restrictions which will see noise not exceed 65 decibels on Thursday and Sunday and only be allowed to rise to 68 decibels from 9 to 11pm on the Saturday and the Sunday. This is a blow to organisers who previously said that getting the increase in sound levels was fundamental to the continued success of the festival in attracting top acts. The original plans, which were shelved days before the committee, would have seen the festival increase its capacity to 80,000 by 2019, with numbers of attendees rising to 76,000 for the next event this August, 9th to the 12th. In response to the decision, Boomtown Community Liaison Officer Anna Wade said, "We respect the decision of the Licence Committee and are happy with the outcome of Friday's hearing. While the decision over the sound level limitation will add extra pressure to the team on the ground, which we're hoping to alleviate with the requested decibel increase, we will continue to work closely with Winchester City Council Environmental Health Department, as well as our sound monitoring and stage teams, to make sure that these levels are upheld." At a drop-in session held by the organisers and Winchester City Council Licence Department at Itchen Abbas in December, Ms. Wade said that they were doing everything they could to minimise disruption, including using acoustic barriers. She said, "If you look at the amount of noise complaints compared to 2012, the number has gone down and keeps going down year on year." Boomtown has already announced world-famous alternative rock band Gorillaz as the first headline act for 2018, which will be the festival's 10th anniversary.
Clampdown on free parking. Freeloading motorists are nearing the end of the road for free parking across Winchester. The City Council is drawing up plans to clamp down on drivers parking for nothing on land council housing schemes. The authority says that some 200 spaces are at risk of being misused by drivers, including commuters and students. Now the council is to consult tenants on introducing permit parking on 16 housing estates across the district. The Cabinet Housing Committee heard that many savvy drivers know that the council cannot legally enforce any restrictions on parking. The committee heard that there were 616 properties affected, and with some works, the 204 parking bays could be increased to around 320. Housing manager Richard Botham said the schemes have parking, but the council has no means to actually control it without a traffic management order, or TMO. For the first year, the parking permits would be free, but afterwards the charge could be around £50 a year, the committee heard. The problem is particularly acute at Greyfriars on Friarsgate, close to the city centre. A TMO has been recently introduced there. Mr. Botham said the scheme could be extended to other places, such as Hyde Lodge. Council leader Caroline Horrell said, "We want our tenants to be able to park effectively, but without enforcement action, people can get free parking. This is a positive step forward in trying to address the issue in a number of locations. We can put up signs, but when people realise there is no enforcement, it is a free-for-all." Councillor Jamie Scott said he was pleased the council could introduce restrictions on parking on grass verges. Michael Fawcett and Monica Gill, members of the Council Tenants Liaison Group TACT, said that they supported the measures. As well as Greyfriars, restrictions are being put in place along Chilcombe Lane at Bar End.
Spreads the love. Winchester Cathedral is spreading the love with free entry this Valentine's Day. With both Ash Wednesday and Valentine's Day falling on February the 14th this year, the cathedral is opening its doors to all visitors, as well as running special tours exploring the meaning of Ash Wednesday, the first day of Lent. To highlight the parallels between Ash Wednesday and Valentine's Day, the cathedral is hosting events and activities inspired by the theme "Love is all you need." In Cathedral Close, visitors can receive ashes on their forehead, informally with "Ashes to Go," the traditional Christian observance of Ash Wednesday. Inside the cathedral, there will be prayers in St. Alfie's Chapel, prayer and confession in the Epiphany Chapel, and prayer stations. There will be several services, starting with morning prayer at 7:40 a.m. and finishing with Solemn Eucharist for Ash Wednesday and Imposition of the Ashes at 5:30 p.m. The Very Reverend Catherine Ogle, Dean of Winchester, said, "On Ash Wednesday, we remember that we are simply human. We can all make mistakes and we can ask for forgiveness. We can let go of resentment and fear and grow into new life and new love. Faithfully following ancient practice while engaging with contemporary culture is an important part of our calling as a cathedral, in order that we can be a place and people of transformation."
Austin's home amongst UK's top cultural sites. The home of a world-famous Hampshire author has been named one of the top places in England after hundreds of nominations from the public. Jane Austen's house in Chawton is amongst 10 places chosen in Historical England's campaign called A History of England in 100 Places in the music and literature category. The novelist's house features alongside such landmark buildings as Abbey Road Studios, the Bronte Parsonage, and Shakespeare's birthplace. Author Monica Alley, who judged the music and literature category, is one of a panel of judges including Professor Lord Robert Winston, George Clark, Mary Beard and Tristram Hunt, who were tasked with choosing their top 10 places in a range of different categories. Jane's house in Chawton was where she lived for the last 8 years of her life, and her novels Sense and Sensibility, Pride and Prejudice and Northanger Abbey were refined and finished there. And she then went on to write Mansfield Park, Emma and Persuasion while living under this roof. Last year, celebrations took place across Hampshire to mark the 200 years since the author's death. Monica Alley said, I was intrigued by the idea of telling the history of England in 100 places, and I was delighted to be asked to judge the music and literature category. The judging process proved to be a reminder of just how rich the nation's history of creativity is, although it was tough to select only 10. But why is it important to celebrate such places, she went on. Well, first of all, it's an acknowledgement of how the arts have shaped our society, especially at a time when arts are becoming more and more marginalised across the country. Secondly, and no less important, these are not only places in which to learn about the past, they also invite contemplation, reflection and, just maybe, inspiration, thus passing the creative baton to future generations. All 10 places picked by Monica will be explored in a new episode of a recently launched podcast hosted by Emma Barnett. Duncan Wilson, Chief Executive of Historic England, said, "From Austin to Orwell to Bronte and the Beatles, these 10 fascinating choices from Monica Alley hint at the sheer range of music and literature hotspots which England has to offer. And of course, that's accompanied by a picture of Jane's house in Chawton."
Secrets revealed of getting to 100 years. Tomato juice and exercise are the key to a long life, according to one Winchester centenarian who celebrated her birthday last Tuesday. Iris Springhall celebrated turning 100, surrounded by family and friends at a party held in Winchester Cathedral's Paul Woodhouse suite. The former youth and fitness model has lived in Winchester for the past 20 years, but was born in Battersea in 1918. Her father owned a butcher shop in the London district, where she worked for several years before moving to Richmond to get a job in a telephone exchange, until she retired at 65 in the early 1980s. Iris met her husband Onslow in Battersea Park, and the pair were married in 1949, when Iris was 30. They were married for 45 years and had two sons, John and Chris. Onslow passed away when he was 79. Her son John, an academic who lectured at the University of Ulster, died 2 years ago at the age of 72. When asked how she feels about turning 100, she said, "I don't feel old. It just happens. It creeps up on you." A keen reader, she said her favourite author is Barbara Pym. "Despite her age, she still looks after herself and tries to be as active as possible. I tried yoga recently, but my back wasn't quite strong enough," she said. However, Iris still enjoys going out for lunch with her son Chris, and up until recently going for walks. In a speech at the party, her son Chris said, "We are here to celebrate the life of an amazing woman," and there is a lovely picture of Iris sitting surrounded by her family, holding balloons, spelling out 100, and she's got her birthday card from the Queen on her lap.
Opening of Chesil Lodge is unclear. The completion date for a major housing scheme in Winchester is still uncertain. The Chesil Lodge development, which includes 52 flats for over 55s, had an initial completion date of November, which was pushed back to this month. But a Winchester City Council spokesman said the official opening date for the centre, currently being built on Chesil Street, has not been confirmed. An assessment of the care needs of potential residents is currently underway, with the council having already secured buyers for the two flats for sale and all six shared ownership flats. The 44 rented flats are available to applicants with an assessed care need. The new building will include a day centre and 24-hour on-site care for residents. Councillor Caroline Horrell, leader of the council with the portfolio for housing services, said, "I am thrilled to see this important building nearing completion. It will offer the highest standards of build and care for residents wanting to stay in their own home, but with the reassurance of on-site care when they need it. The overall quality of the development is excellent, and I am reassured by the care and diligence being taken by Galliford Try and the Council's new homes team to ensure that quality of the construction is not compromised. I am really looking forward to personally welcoming the first residents to the scheme. The City Council states that the contractor, Galliford Try, has encountered a number of design challenges, which has resulted in a longer build than originally anticipated, but that the cost of the delay falls to them and not the council. Back in November, the City Council was unable to confirm how much they were seeking for the delays when asked by the Chronicle under the Freedom of Information Act. When asked whether Galliford Try were being fined £15,000 a week due to the delay, a spokeswoman said, "The construction contract between Galliford Try and Winchester City Council sets out the position regarding delays to the completion date caused by either party. The council will seek liquidated and ascertained damages as provided for in the contract for any delays for which we consider Galliford Try is responsible. LADS are based on the loss of income to Winchester City Council caused by the delay of rents and sales."
And that concludes the extracts for this week. Thank you to our editors, Angela Ling, Carol Fraser and Jane Thomas. Thanks to our copying, dispatch and studio preparation teams. And thanks to our readers, Maria Head.
Goodbye.
John Regan.
Bye-bye now.
And Daphne Poupart.
Goodbye.
And from me, Vara Williams, goodbye and have a good week. And please post your memory sticks back as soon as possible in the yellow wallet. And when you put your label inside, please make sure that the cord attached to the memory stick is fully inside the wallet as well. Thank you.